The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Our bad science columnist, who also moonlights as a doctor, has tweeted, "Let's be clear. All that matters in politics right now is saving the NHS from Andrew Lansley." Is he right, or is it a touch hysterical? We dedicate this show to health so that you can judge for yourself. Now, the bill appears to be in a critical condition, but as the Prime Minister vows to push on regardless, can the government get its reforms off life support and onto the statute book? And, crucially, at what political cost? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian columnist, Polly Toynbee, our social affairs editor, Randeep Ramesh, and Stephen Thornton of the Health Foundation, who has spent a career in the health service and now has a seat on the board of Monitor, the regulator at the heart of the controversial reforms. A very warm welcome to you all. Now, after more than 1,000 amendments, a pause for thought and 18 months of legislating, it's make or break time. This week, David Cameron rode in behind his embattled Health Secretary, Andrew Lansley, but nonetheless, Ed Miliband landed several blows.
The person who's moving the goalposts is the Prime Minister. The reality is that the key test that was set for the health service was the number of people waiting more than 18 weeks. And that number is up 43% since the general election. However much he twists and turns, that is the reality. And look, Mr. Speaker, he knows in his heart of hearts this is a complete disaster, this bill. That's why his aides are saying the health secretary should be taken out and shot, because they know it's a disaster. The reality about this bill is this: the doctors know it's bad for the NHS, the nurses know it's bad for the NHS, and patients know it's bad for the NHS. Every day he fights for this bill, every day trust in him on the NHS ebbs away, and every day it becomes clearer the health service is not safe in his hands.
I've got to tell him, the career prospects for my right honourable friend are a lot better than his.
Well, last week it was the Royal College of GPs who joined nurses, physiotherapists, the BMA and 50,000 petitioners in voicing opposition to the bill. Randy, nobody likes it, but they don't care. It's heading into law, isn't it?
Well, it probably is heading into law. I mean, the law's job is to scrutinise legislation, not to send it to the dustbin of history. So in that sense, all they can really do is to amend the bill, send it back to the Commons. The Commons then have to agree or disagree. We could enter a period of ping pong. The one open question is what happens if the bill doesn't make it into law by about March the 28th, because then we're into the period up until the local elections. Very difficult government to get any message out, and the reaction on the doorstep will be pretty bad. There has to be written into law before the next Queen's speech, which I don't think they've announced yet. I think it's about May the 9th we're expecting that. So if it isn't law by then it isn't law.
Well, that is interesting. I mean, I'd say the odds are still on for it, though. But Stephen, you understand these things from an expert point of view. Let's just take a few steps back and do what maybe Andrew Lansley has failed to do and explain what he was trying to do in the first place with this bill.
Yeah, I think that's quite important, because at the moment we've got ourselves into a really fixed position. You're either for or against the bill, rather than wondering whether we're for and against the inherent underlying policy behind the bill. And I think actually this government was very, very poor in putting across what its underlying policy intention was, really. And it seems to me that any government faced with trying to deal with the NHS, trying to make care better for patients, really can only do three things. It can enhance professionalism. It can say we rely on the inherent trustworthiness of doctors and nurses to deliver stuff. And we know that can be very good, but we also know that that can be very difficult. It can get into command and control. It can say we're taking command of all of this top down. We can set some targets. We can get stuff done, if you like. And we know there's been success in the past with that, but we also know the backwash of all of that. And the third thing they can do is they can say, I know, let's introduce markets into healthcare, because there's some evidence around the world that that can work. But we also know there's a lot of evidence around the world of how difficult and damaging actually that can be. So, you know, they've got to balance those three things. And I think when this government came into power, they of course it's a coalition, but Andrew Lansley had his plan, as it were, that he'd been working on for many years. And I think that plan, my interpretation of that plan, was to place as it were, turn up the volume knob on the market bit of that and on the professional bit of that simultaneously, right? In a way that I think was sort of fundamentally incompatible. And so we've got one half of the bill that started off being about the new role of monitor and promoting competition. And then on the other side, we've got of the bill, we've got the role that GPs are going to play in commissioning and so on and so forth. And I don't think those two aspects were ever properly thought through and balanced. Meanwhile, David Nicholson, who's the chief executive of the NHS, looking at the financial problems of the NHS and the different economic world we're in, is going, gosh, I've got to hang on to my command and control here. It's the only way I know how to run the business, as it were, kind of thing. And that's where we've ended up. So the debate we now need is take those three things that government can do and let's work through the balance of what they should be. And I'll put my cards on the table and say there should always be an element of those three things. To exclude any one of them is taking away opportunities from government. The difficult thing is getting the right balance.
So what you're saying is that there's three things there: competition on the one hand, and then professionalism and command and control. You need a bit of each of them. Lansley thought he was going to go full blaze for two of the three. His chief civil servant, David Nicholson, former communist, of course, is keen on the command and control and has hung on to that. And so we've got all guns blazing on all three points on your triangle,
well,
if you like.
Well, we did when this all started. Of course, 18 months has gone by and we've had the listening exercise and we've had everybody playing into this. And so the volume control on these three things is now in a rather different place. So I think, this is, again, put my cards on the table, I think the discussions we've had about the market have turned the volume down on that to a point where I'm personally rather happier with where we could end up than I would have been when this started. I think the government's also woken up realising that they're putting all the eggs in one basket of GPs was not actually dealing with the proper wide range of professionalism. It was picking out one group and thinking that they were going to lead on all that. So we've got to a slightly better place on that. But frankly, I think the commissioning side is still terribly confused. Meanwhile, I think there is now an acknowledgement that there are some command and control aspects that always need to be in place. I mean, we've heard, you know, how stroke services have improved in London. That's happened largely through rational planning by people coming together and working out how best to do it. It works.
Now, Polly, what I take away from that is maybe through the messiest and ugliest route imaginable, it might just be that we've chanced upon a reasonable balance in this bill, which we shouldn't forget has had 1,000 amendments and all the rest of it. It wasn't what Lansley planned, but do you think there's any chance that he's stumbled into the right balance here?
I think he's running into such deep trouble anyway for just having done a huge reorganisation before you even think about what kind of reorganisation. The one thing that I thought that Cameron and Lansley understood was there will be no top-down reorganisation, not because it was a populist message, but because they'd seen how often Labour had turned it upside down after the Tories had turned it upside down, re-disorganisation over and over again, in which, you know, leading professionals lose maybe 18 months of productivity worrying about the deck chairs in their offices and the brass nameplates and reapplying for their jobs. That's the first disaster. Now, to do that at a time when Stephen Dorrell, head of the Health Select Committee, has said no health service ever has tried to cut 4% a year for 1 year, let alone 4 years in a row, it's not doable. At the same time, you know, drastic cuts and reorganisation. So that before we even analyse the nature of the beast itself is very beastly. And I think the other odd thing about it is that GPs are the most under-scrutinised small business part of the NHS that Bevan never managed to properly get inside the NHS. Very peculiar to hand over to them, quite unregulated, in a way that no other country does, so much money and such complete power. When we know, what we do know about them is that they're very, very varied and a lot of them not very good at commissioning type, rationing type operation. So to put the whole of the rationing to their hands was so scary, they've had to pull back. And lots of GPs are employing KPMG, which will be expensive, and they're more likely to commission from the private sector. And the GPs are now very cross too. Everybody's cross. I think it was utterly ill-conceived from the beginning, but the main reason is the market and monitor, that although they've changed the words back to front, it remains the case that monitor is there to guarantee competition. Every single part of the NHS is up for sale. Anybody who wants to challenge and to tender for some bit of it, as long as they are a qualified provider, can do so, opening it up to European law in a way that, although Blair started it, this is of quite another dimension.
Randeep, just on the point about GPs, they are, as Polly said there, you know, small business people who were suddenly being given control of these purse strings. Some of us might think, oh, Christmas is all come at once for them. So how significant do you think it is that they just said, no, we don't want anything to do with it in the last week or so?
Oh, it's pretty significant. I mean, one has to take into account the leadership of the Royal College has set its face against the reforms when they were first put out. When the new leader took over, Claire Gerada, her first interview was, you know, doctors' surgeries are going to be picketed by their patients because they'll be taking rationing decisions. This is the wrong thing to do. So she's been a long-time critic, and most GPs have swung behind her, I think, as they've seen basically a mess develop. I mean, A, the PCTs above them have disappeared. They've been rushing off. I know several GPs have been rushing off 2 days a week trying to work out how to make rationing decisions, how to manage budgets. Then they sort of run into the brick wall of, oh dear, my budget's being cut by 15% this year. What am I going to do? They're already feeling it, and they know how difficult that is. And that process is going to continue for the next 4 or 5 years. So they don't enjoy that, which is why I think the college has turned its back against it. Can I make a point here, which I think sort of is something that both Polly and Stephen have raised, which is whether you can actually downsize healthcare costs. There's a very eminent economist called William Balmore who first promulgated, I think, in the 1960s, that it wasn't possible actually to downscale healthcare for good reasons. If you considered a Mozart string quintet in 1783, they basically did the same thing then as they do now. Yet why have their wages gone up? Now, that question is exactly the same for healthcare. You can't actually apply market principles, i.e. make them more efficient, give them less time, without affecting patient care. Now, this is important. This is important because what it says is that healthcare costs rise, and they rise partly due to increasing demand, but also because of labour influence, about the costs that you're built into the system. And when we see white goods, their costs dropping, you can still buy a TV today, even though your wages are falling, but you can't afford public services. That's the circle I think Lansley is trying to square, using the levers that Stephen has discussed. Now, you see, competition worked from 2005 in the health service under Choose and Book because we had rising budgets. The question is, will competition work when you have flat or falling budgets? No one's answered that. And I think behind all the rhetoric, that's really the policy problem that we all face. Can you actually do more with less? And no one in healthcare seems to think you can.
I mean, that, Stephen, is very much the context, isn't it? And it's become to light maybe more sharply in the last few months as people have realised what frozen real terms budgets mean. Before, those nice posts of David Cameron saying we'll cut the deficit but never the NHS. Do you think that is why, more than anything of the detail of the bill and the balance between competition and the rest of it, do you think it's just the dawning realisation that there's going to be cuts whatever happens is why it's all got so controversial?
I do. And I wouldn't just restrict this to the market component of this discussion. I mean, you're absolutely right in saying we don't know whether the introduction of markets can successfully contribute to this in the downturn situation. But actually, we don't know whether the command and control approach or whether the professionalism approach that I was outlining, what the impact of those incentives is going to be in
this
downturn
situation.
So there
may be no solution.
Recently, I had the opportunity of listening to the leaders of Aravind Eye Care in India. Right, they are an eye care provider in India that provides as much eye care as is provided in the UK. I mean, we're talking scale here, right? And they are able to do a cataract operation, a successful cataract operation, with results that are better than in the UK NHS for eye care for $15. Okay, they can provide eye care for the same population in India as we provide eye care for in the UK for 1/100th of the price.
Right.
Now, I'm not arguing any means that we can simply transfer the one to the other. But that is an important challenge for us. Yeah. Imagine we could provide it at half of the
but
cost
and
at the highest quality.
Stephen, you've picked on a really easy thing. Whenever politicians
well, let's do
this,
it then.
They
if it's easy,
but
then
they
let's
tend
do
to
it.
Pick on simple cold surgery, planned surgery. Most of the NHS is old people with complex needs, you know, break their hip and turn out to have kidney and diabetic and all sorts of other things too. Most of the NHS is messy and difficult. Yeah. The great success in the NHS in recent years is the thing that you mentioned, stroke care, also cancer care and heart care, where what really mattered was getting everybody working together so that the ambulance driver knows where to take that stroke patient, all the hospitals in the local area work together and decide who's on duty and where and who's going to do the stroke patients. They get instant treatment and they get instant physiotherapy afterwards. And it all works because it's integrated and coordinated. Yeah. Now, the idea that each of those elements are going to compete with each other and have different contracts, not integrated, with different GPs hiring different people. In one of these areas, I think it's in the Wirral, the GPs wouldn't commission one of the hospitals in the system, which broke the pathway. And that's going to happen all over the place, over and over again. It doesn't make sense to fragment the whole system down to groups of GPs picking what takes their fancy or whatever they happen to know.
I agree with that. I just don't see, as I look into the future and I look at this bill, I don't see that that is naturally, inevitably going to happen.
Right.
Again, it's about ensuring that we have this effectively regulated such that any competition is in the interests of patients and takes account of the sort of integration things we've talked about here. I mean, you know, we can point to health and social service care in Northern Ireland, which has been unified under single organisation, single payer, single provider for a generation, right? The interconnection and the coordination between hospitals and social services in Northern Ireland is frankly no better than it is in many other parts.
Well, social services is another matter. We were talking about integration.
But we mustn't presume that integration means that that the services that are provided have to be run, managed, and owned by the same people, and don't necessarily have to be owned and managed by the state. Right? I'm not a proponent of open market forces here, but I think we need to distinguish between who runs and owns various bits of this from the commissioning intention to commission integrated
care.
This is where I come back to saying I agree with Polly here, right? That if that's what we want, then I'm not sure that GPs in the current form described are the best people, the best institution in order to hand over this massive responsibility for taking billions of pounds worth of taxpayers' money and spending it in the right way for patients. To me, that is the big weakness in the whole of these proposals.
Could you just say a little bit about, you know, because the allegation from the forces ranged against the bill in the House of Lords is very much that specifically the danger of getting caught up in European competition law and the role of a monitor, which you're on the board of, will mean that the sort of planning and coordination Polly's talking about, that, you know, when it comes to, I don't know, stroke care or something, will be much harder to do.
As originally conceived, maybe by Andrew Lansley, where the statement was fairly bald, that it was about, quotes, promoting competition, almost with some sort of political fundamental belief that this was the way to solve the problem of healthcare. I would agree that there was a danger that that was going to lead us into difficult territory. But I think in the last 18 months, the way in which this has been openly debated has got us to a point of realizing that markets and competition can provide some assistance, can contribute in some way, but have to be done in the public interest and in the interest of patients. Now, you know, fairly recently, Monitor took an important decision about the merger of a mental health service, where we came down very much in the public interest that it was right that this should go ahead, despite the fact that we were told that this would, you know, in broad terms, limit competition, right, kind of thing. And that's the sort of dilemma that Monitor will be faced with going forward, and needs to remember what it will say in the bill if this goes into law, that this has to be done absolutely in the interests of patients, and that integration is critically important. So, you know, I just don't share the view that somehow this is all going to lead to, you know, NHS up for sale. I kind of just don't see the connection between the legislation
that's currently conceived
and that place.
But any American or European company that fancies, and indeed it's actually been advertised to them in New York, fancies some bit of the NHS that looks juicy, cannot be prevented from being allowed to come and bid.
Well, I just don't see that. Hospitals are not up for sale. Publicly funded healthcare is not, as I see it, I mean, it may be wrong, but as I see it reading this bill, is not up for sale. So I don't. Could I
just sort of bring it back to the interests of the patients, which is the phrase you continually used? I mean, I think that the integration that you described through the mechanism why different providers along a pathway of care would be involved. You see, for vulnerable people or anybody who's ill, the thought of repeating tests, going to different places, carrying around a bit of papers, I mean, these things happen today. The charge is that they may get worse. Now, the alternative model, and I'll use the US because Kaiser Permanente do it, is that long vertical integrated healthcare system, the old regional health boards, if you like, where one person was the sort of gateway for all of that. And it was their responsibility to look after much of the patients.
Yes, but Kaiser operates in the market.
Well, I only...
They provide integrated care.
The competition is somewhere
within
else.
Within a market system.
Hang on. I think that in the interest of the patients, if you were a patient, which system would you... And I don't mean the competitive market that Kaiser has to sort of offer its services. I mean, entering the Kaiser kind of or the regional health authority model, is that better for the patient? Is that better in the interest? Rather than this pathway where different providers are coming along and saying, do this, do that. Oh, can you bring this form with you? Don't eat, sit down. The prerogative of how the patient has to respond resides with these providers rather than the patient saying to them, well, actually, I don't want to do that. I don't want to sort of not eat for 5 hours just because it suits you.
Well, I mean, I've no doubt in my mind, if I became resident in the US, I would choose to have my healthcare with Kaiser Permanente. I think it's a brilliant system.
But Polly's point is just
that. But it's not the same as, it's not the same as the old regional health authority-led command and control system that we've had here. It's different from that. You can't equate the two.
But Kaiser's model is the care trusts are a good example of that, because they were partly modelled on that system, weren't they?
Yeah. And
they're being swept away by the bill.
Don't see it. Don't understand this sweeping away, this NHS up for sale. It just doesn't...
Well, Stephen Dorrell's own comment was, it's not an attractive conclusion
I think the contrast between care trusts and Kaiser Permanente's structure is a little involved, even for the dear listeners of the Guardian Politics podcast. So, Polly, can we just bring it back for a moment to low politics? Andrew Lansley, finished or not?
I think so, because I think that even if there weren't a reorganisation, the NHS was running into bad trouble simply because every time it doesn't get 2% extra a year, it runs into bad trouble. Mrs Thatcher found that when John Moore allowed it to fall below, and she then had to do a huge reorganisation and pump lots of money in, let alone a 4% cut. So I think a health secretary is pretty much destined for the chop when real trouble hits. I mean, already long waits are up by 43%. Came across a waiting list clerk who told me the other day that they are now gaming the waiting lists so that if you've waited over 18 weeks, you're going to wait for a very long time because they're the ones who are not treated because you've already gone over, whereas they'll treat somebody who's only waited 17 weeks. And so all of this is happening all over again. And there are going to be lots of patients very angry, very upset, and lots of horrible stories. And if there's a winter flu crisis this winter, next winter, I think Lansley will take the blame because he has done such a cavalier and disastrously malfunctioning reorganisation at such a time.
Well, Stephen, obviously you wouldn't want to comment on the chances of Lansley surviving or not, but let's just imagine that Polly's right and that he ends up getting shunted out in the summer. You've had 2 years now. I'm just trying to bring this back to what this means for the NHS staff and the NHS people trying to manage this process in particular. We had a very rigid white paper. It's then been rewritten whilst it's moving through Commons and pause and thousands of... And then potentially you're going to get this law through and a few months later you're going to have a new health secretary who might not have started from here. How do you think someone trying to run a primary care trust who doesn't know if they're... You know, who's been clustered and then moved over to a clinical commissioning group and all the rest of it. Yes. How do you think they're feeling?
Well, frankly, I think the most important thing is to get a bit of stability back. I mean, Paul is absolutely right. You know, government coming in saying no intention to reorganise, and then we go through the biggest reorganisation I can remember in my career, right? A gargantuan upheaval. And I think we've got to get back to having some stability there. So I'm almost at the point of thinking, and this might be sounding like I'm sort of damning this bill with some faint praise, we need to get this over. We need to get it through in some form so that people can then settle down and say, right, let's look at this new landscape and let's let's have some reasonable certainty here over the next few years to kind of move forward on the big problem. Again, Polly's absolutely right. The big problem is, how is the health service going to manage in these reduced financial circumstances going forward if whatever government we have at the time is not going to provide those resources?
So it seems that we've come to the rather dismal end point of saying we need any order is better than a disorder, and maybe that's where we are. It's all we've got time for this week, so my thanks to Polly Toynbee, to Randeep Ramesh and to Stephen Thornton. You can follow all the news coverage and analysis on the NHS and the rest of the Guardian's politics coverage at guardian.co.uk/politics. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.